after vacation. I hope you did something thoroughly frivolous. And what we're going to do today is pick up the story of nerve-nerve communication. Dr. Feierstein explained how you get a message down a nerve. I'm going to turn the mic down just a little bit. So if you have an action potential traveling down an axon, he explained how it is regenerated at each point, and then how it leads to the opening of calcium channels, which leads to exocytosis, which leads to the release of neurotransmitter. So neurotransmitter is released, and it binds to receptors on the surface of the postsynaptic cell. So there's the presynaptic side, the postsynaptic, and the synaptic cleft. Now, he talked about how you get the signal across the synaptic cleft, but he didn't mention how you get rid of it. Whenever you have a signal, such as with hormones, for example, we said you have to turn the signal off. For example, if the ligand, which is a signal molecule, causes the production of cyclic AMP, which activates a G protein, you have to be able to turn that off. So we know that G proteins hydrolyze their own GTP and turn themselves off. And we know that there's phosphodiesterase, which destroys cyclic GMP. There are different phosphodiesterases. Some destroy cyclic AMP, some cyclic GMP, as in the case of Viagra. And so you get rid of the second messenger, you inactivate the G protein, and you turn the signal off. When we talked about growth factors, when we talked about receptor-mediated endocytosis, we say, how do you turn off signaling with EGF? You have receptor-mediated endocytosis, and you zap both the receptor and the signal molecule. So anytime you have signaling, you have to be able to turn off the signal. So how do you turn off this signal? The basic idea is to get the neurotransmitter out of the cleft. Once you get rid of it, then the receptor will no longer be activated, and we won't have any change in the postsynaptic cell. Now, one way of getting rid of neurotransmitter is just to let it diffuse away. And the reason that often works is that many neurotransmitters are small molecules. Most of them are. And so even if they're in high concentration here, they're low concentration elsewhere, and they just diffuse away. So this is one way of getting rid of it. Another way is simply to destroy the neurotransmitter, to degrade it. Now, the most famous example of that involves acetylcholine esterase. You may remember that acetylcholine is one of the major neurotransmitters outside the central nervous system. This, in fact, is the neurotransmitter between muscle and nerve, actually from nerve to muscle. And it's therefore extremely important. It's also involved in some nerve-nerve, as we'll see next time. So this is a major neurotransmitter. Now, it is destroyed by acetylcholine esterase, which actually resides in the synaptic cleft. So the esterase is here. And as soon as the acetylcholine is released, it is destroyed. Acetylcholine is an ester between the acetate part and the choline part. So the esterase breaks it into its two halves. And the choline is actually taken back up into the cell, reacetylated and reused, and the acetate is degraded further or diffuses away. So degrading or destroying your signal is number two. And number three is reuptake of your signal. Now, if you can remember back to exam one of infamous memory, though two probably at the moment, is bigger in your memory, that there was a problem there about the reuptake of serotonin. Serotonin, which is derived from amino acids, but is not an amino acid. Serotonin is another major transmitter, mostly in the brain, in the central nervous system, not in the peripheral. And the way you get rid of serotonin, generally, is by taking it back up into the cell that released it. And norepinephrine is also removed from the cleft by reuptake. And the reason that this is an important neurotransmitter is that it is the other major neurotransmitter in the peripheral nervous system. The two major ones outside the brain and the spinal cord are acetylcholine and norepinephrine, and you'll hear a lot more about both of them. So these two are recovered not by receptor-mediated endocytosis, but by secondary active transport. So by active transport, these small molecules are put back into the cytoplasm. By endocytosis, the vesicle membrane is recovered, and then the transmitters are pumped again by active transport into the empty vesicle to remake stocked vesicles for another round. So exocytosis releases the neurotransmitter, endocytosis gets the membrane back, active transport gets the transmitter back. And then inside the cell, you have to put them back together again. Now, many drugs, as indicated on that exam, work at least partially because they slow reuptake. If reuptake is slower, then it means that the transmitter sits around longer in the cleft, triggers more response in the postsynaptic cell, and you get more bang for your buck. And Prozac and malathione, Prozac actually prevents serotonin reuptake. That may not be its only effect, but that's one of them. And other drugs affect not just reuptake, but other steps of this process. For example, malathione, which is an insecticide and nerve gas, inhibit acetylcholine esterase. They inhibit this enzyme, thereby blocking degradation of acetylcholine. Now remember we said that acetylcholine is the major signal molecule between nerve and muscle. So if you block acetylcholine esterase, the signal to muscle to contract doesn't stop. So the signal of muscle to contract continues, and the individual goes into spasms because their muscles just keep contracting. In the case of malathione, this is desirable. This is when you see that bug lying on its back going like this, that's because it got the zap. If it's acetylcholine esterase. Okay. So we understand a little bit now about how you clear out the cleft so that you can have another signal. But now what I want to do is look more on the postsynaptic side. How do you put together the chemical signals that come in and decide, so to speak, whether to fire an action potential on the postsynaptic side? So Dr. Feierstein talked about the basic idea, and I want to fill in some of the details. Now, we know that a neurotransmitter can be either inhibitory or excitatory. If you consider a cell with a resting membrane potential, whatever it happens to be, usually it's about minus 70 millivolts. When the neurotransmitter comes along and binds to its receptor, this receptor, this arresting membrane potential can now change. Now, what causes it to change? In biochemistry, the magic word is usually either enzyme or ATP. But in neuroscience, the magic word is usually ion channels. So in this case, it's ion channels. You open ion channels and ions move. Now, depending on the charge on the ion and on which way it moves, either you shift the resting membrane potential in that direction or the other. Now, what are the consequences here? Threshold is up here somewhere. And also zero is in this direction also. So if we make the resting membrane potential less negative, move it toward zero, we're moving it toward threshold. And now, is the cell going to be easier to fire or harder to fire? That's going to make it easier. So we shift up toward threshold. That's called an excitatory postsynaptic potential, or an EPSP. And a single EPSP is what you get generally from one action potential's worth. That is, one action potential coming in releases one packet, one amount of neurotransmitter, a certain number of vesicles, and that's enough to cause one excitatory postsynaptic potential on the next cell. Now, on the other hand, if different channels are open and different ions move, the cell may become more negative or hyperpolarized, as distinguished from depolarized. Now, if a cell becomes hyperpolarized, it's further away from threshold, further away from zero, more negative, and harder to fire. So this change is called an inhibitory PSP, or an IPSP. Now, whether a particular neurotransmitter is excitatory or inhibitory depends on its receptor partner. Many neurotransmitters are always excitatory, others are always inhibitory, and some can be either one. Norepinephrine can be either one. It depends on the receptor, because the receptor opens the channels. And which channels are open and which ions move determine whether you get an EPSP or an IPSP. And as seems, I hope, fairly obvious, whether the postsynaptic cell will fire an action potential depends on the net sum algebraically of all the inputs, excitatory and inhibitory. And we'll do an example of that. But first, let's think for a minute about the receptor protein itself. A particular neurotransmitter binds to its respective receptor. Now, maybe before we do that and before we leave this, we should ask which ions moving have an inhibitory effect, which ions an excitatory effect. We could put it the other way using the famous ion channel rule. What kind of channel do you have to open, for example, to get an inhibitory response? You have to make the cell. The cell is mostly neutral, actually, but it's a little bit minus on the edge. So to make have an inhibitory effect, we have to make it what? On the inside. Relatively more negative. So we could either have negative ions moving in or positive ions moving out. Either one would achieve that effect. So what is the ion you can let out which will make the cell more negative? Potassium is the usual. So usually this is a potassium channel that's opened, and potassium comes out. or a sodium, excuse me, a chloride channel is opened and chloride goes in. Chloride, as you will see, is generally higher on the outside than the inside, just as potassium is higher on the inside than it is on the outside. Now, what would happen if you let sodium move? The net push on sodium from both chemical and electric is in. So if you let sodium in, the cell would become more positive and you would have an excitatory postsynaptic potential. Now, to get inhibition, you have to let potassium out and not let the sodium move. So you have to have a channel that only allows potassium to move. But to let sodium in, as we mentioned last time, you can open a general cation channel or a monovalent cation channel that allows both potassium and sodium. Now, if I open a channel that allows both of these to move, why will I get more movement of sodium? Which of these is closer to its equilibrium potential at minus 70? Potassium is quite close to its equilibrium potential. So if you let potassium move, only a little bit moves. It'll move out, but only a little bit. If you let sodium move, a lot of sodium moves, and it moves in. So the net effect of this is that the sodium in, as we said last time, is much greater than the potassium out, and the net effect is an excitatory postsynaptic potential. So neurotransmitters that are excitatory generally open nonspecific cation channels, while monovalent cation channels. While inhibitory neurotransmitters that are inhibitory generally open channels either for potassium or chloride. So how does binding of the neurotransmitter or any ligand to its receptor cause the opening or sometimes the closing of channels? There are two basic ways this works. They are actually in Dr. Feierstein's notes, but I don't think I mentioned them last time. That receptors come in two basic categories, which are usually called ionotropic and metabotropic. But this being biology, of course, we have multiple names for things. These are called, ionotropic are called direct, metabotropic indirect. And the big deal is the receptor itself a channel, binds its ligand and opens? Ionotropic or direct receptors are always opened in response to binding their ligand. Either they don't do anything or they open. So the receptor itself is a channel. But in the case of metabotropic receptors, the receptor itself is not a channel. The receptor is usually a G protein-coupled receptor, which activates a G protein, and the G protein now either opens or closes a channel, either directly or using a second messenger. So you have multiple steps here, that's why it's called indirect. And this time you can either open a channel or close it. So metabotropic receptors are more flexible, more things, different things can happen, but they're slower. So some responses use ionotropic, some use metabotropic. Now, for example, one of the most famous acetylcholine receptors is ionotropic. All the receptors for epinephrine and norepinephrine, these are indirect. These are all proteins, G protein coupled receptors that indirectly trigger the opening of channels. They are not channels themselves. Now, for acetylcholine, there are actually two major types of receptors. Now, I have to warn you that the receptor business gets very complicated. There's a table in your notes to try and summarize some of the critical facts. That there are two major classes of receptors for acetylcholine and two major classes of receptors for norepinephrine and epinephrine. And their properties are summarized there. One of the acetylcholine receptors is ionotropic, but the second type of acetylcholine receptor is in fact metabotropic. Now, people often talk about the acetylcholine receptor. That's because this is the world's most famous receptor. And that is the one that's at the nerve muscle synapse or the nerve muscle junction. And that's this one. This is the acetylcholine receptor. While the one that is metabotropic is found elsewhere and is the other one. Now, people don't like to talk about number one and number two or this one and the other one. So they have a name for these two. And where that comes from is from agonists of these receptors. You've probably all heard of antagonists. Antagonists block things. Antagonists bind to receptors and other proteins and prevent the proteins from doing their thing. And the way antagonists work is they bind to the target protein instead of the normal ligand, and they jam the system. So they bind. But how do signal molecules respond? How does a receptor get any action? When the receptor binds its ligand, it changes conformation. That's why we always draw this picture. Here's the receptor. You add the ligand, and the receptor changes conformation. So what an antagonist does is it binds to the receptor, but it doesn't change the conformation. So you get no action, you just block it. An agonist, on the other hand, is like a fake ligand. It binds to the receptor, and it triggers the conformational change. So it's a mimic of the ligand. It's a kind of mimic. But many agonists have properties that are different from that of the natural ligand. They either bind better, they bind worse. They're more easily degraded, they're less easily degraded, etc., etc. So they're often very important either as drugs or as lab tools for figuring out what's going on. Both antagonists and agonists are of enormous scientific importance, both research-wise and medically. So to come back to our example, and this is summarized in the table, the acetylcholine receptors binds the compound nicotine. In other words, nicotine, as in cigarettes, is an agonist of acetylcholine, of the acetylcholine receptor. And so the acetylcholine receptor is called the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. The other acetylcholine receptor binds a different compound and has different properties. Its famous agonist is called muscarin, which is derived from a mushroom. And so this is called the muscarinic acetylcholine receptor. So maybe I should say the terminology one more time because it's going to come up again and again. We have here two basic classes of receptor that differ in their transmitter. Those that respond to acetylcholine and those that bind to epinephrine, norepinephrine. And this is summarized in your table. But I'm going to say it one more time. What do you call the corresponding receptors? The receptors that bind acetylcholine are called adrenergic receptors. No, they're not. They're called cholinergic. They're called cholinergic receptors after the choline part of acetylcholine. And the receptors that bind epinephrine and norepinephrine are called adrenergic receptors. I'm not responsible for this. The reason for that is another name for norepinephrine and epinephrine is adrenaline. So things that bind adrenaline are called adrenergic. And I want to remind you that the difference between norepinephrine and epinephrine, aka adrenaline and noradrenaline, is just one methyl group. One of these is primarily used as a hormone, one is primarily used as a neurotransmitter, but they have very similar actions. So we have cholinergic receptors and adrenergic receptors. And we just said that the cholinergic receptors are divided into nicotinic and muscarinic, depending on the agonist. But they're very different in action. One of these is itself a channel, and the other is a G-protein coupled receptor that affects channels. Now, adrenergic are also divided into two basic categories called alpha and beta. And the sad news is that they are in turn subdivided into multiple kinds, which we won't go into. It turns out that an enormous number of drugs work by interfering with or promoting the action of these various neurotransmitters. And that's why it's important to keep them straight and to know about them. Now, maybe we should say from the table just one more thing about this alpha versus beta business. These were originally distinguished by whether they bound better to norepinephrine or epinephrine. But from our point of view, the point that's really interesting is that the beta ones all use cyclic AMP. They all use the pathway that we talked about before, where the G-protein coupled receptor triggers a G-protein, which triggers adenyl cyclase, which generates cyclic AMP, et cetera, et cetera. But the alpha ones vary in how they work, and we'll talk about one example later today. Okay. So, let's leave receptorology for a while and come back to the question of, at any given synapse, you have one major neurotransmitter and one major receptor. Now, therefore, at this synapse, you are going to generate either an excitatory postsynaptic potential or an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. But if this is a normal postsynaptic cell, it has many, many inputs, many, many synapses. Some of those will be excitatory, and some of those will be inhibitory. So what determines if the postsynaptic cell is going to fire an action potential in its axon? So to answer that, we have to consider the issue of summation. And this is on 15A on the bottom. Where we have a recording from the postsynaptic cell. So if you consider the postsynaptic cell, remember it has the axon hillock here, and then it has an axon surrounded by myelin. And there are multiple inputs or synapses on this postsynaptic cell. So this is the pre and the post. Now, You can't tell this from your picture, but and your picture shows the postsynaptic cell with proper dendrites, etc. This synaptic ending here, this bouton, is not inside the postsynaptic cell. It's on top. You can't tell that from the picture. So this postsynaptic cell is outside releasing neurotransmitter. The presynaptic cell is releasing neurotransmitter, which hits the receptors on the postsynaptic cell, and then what happens? So if we were to record, say, at the axon hillock, we would get those pictures that are shown underneath. So if you have one action potential coming down, this is meant to be an excitatory synapse. So if we have one action potential, we generate here in the postsynaptic cell an excitatory postsynaptic potential. And this will spread around the cell. But it will eventually die out if there is nothing else. This size, one action potential generates an excitatory postsynaptic potential, which is too small to reach threshold. So if you have one action potential, and then you wait a little while, and you have another action potential, you get the recording shown there. The first excitatory postsynaptic potential dies away before the second one comes, and nothing happens. So you don't fire an action potential. But now what happens in case B, which is a different case, I think, in your notes? What happens if you fire two excitatory action potentials right after each other? Then what happens is you have the first one, and before the first one can die off, you get a second one on top, and that's sufficient to cross the threshold and generate an action potential. And this is called temporal summation, summation in time. EPSPs that are short, that are close enough together, add up. Now there's another kind of summation, and that's summation in space or spatial summation. That's shown in your third picture. What if you considered two synapses at a time, and each one was excitatory? And suppose two APs came in at the same time, one down E1 and one down E2. So you'd have two simultaneous postsynaptic potentials, excitatory, and the effects would add up. And that would be sufficient to trigger an action potential. Now, what if you have an inhibitory synapse? If you have an inhibitory synapse all by itself, what happens? You get something like this. But now what happens if you fire an inhibitory, this is the third case, the very last case. What happens if you fire an inhibitory and an excitatory at the same time? Well, you get the algebraic sum. So the algebraic sum of excitatory and inhibitory is you just stay at resting membrane potential, and you don't get an action potential, and nothing happens. So these are the cases that are shown here in your handout. And you have to remember that there are about 1,000 synapses on the dendrites and cell body of the average neuron. And therefore, what happens is not the sum of two, but the sum of all 1,000, inhibitory and excitatory, determine whether the cell will fire an AP or not. Now, before we go on, we've talked about two kinds of changes in potential. We've talked about these EPSPs and IPSPs. We've talked about postsynaptic potentials and action potentials. And it's worth thinking How are they the same and how are they different? And I noticed that in the notes, this is back a little bit. Okay. Well, what about the sign of the change? What about an action potential? It's always positive. You always depolarize. It's followed by a hyperpolarization, but you always depolarize. But what about postsynaptic potentials? Remember, they can be inhibitory, they can be excitatory, they can be hyperpolarization or depolarization. Now, what about the size? In a normal cell, does this size of this spike change? No, it does not. You can get more of them or less of them, but you always get the same size signal. As I think Dr. Feierstein said, it's all action potentials all the time. So you just get more or less of them, but they're always the same size. Now, what about postsynaptic potentials? A single IPSP or EPSP is probably always the same size. It's due to one action potential's jolt of transmitter. But from what a cell is experiencing at any one moment, what about that? Can you have more or less? You certainly can, because if you have lots of excitatory input, then you have lots of EPSPs that add up. And if you have lots of inhibitory, they add up, and if you had both, they cancel out. So in fact, this is constant, but these are said to be graded. The more input, the bigger the response. Some people have compared these two types of signals to analog and digital. That a graded potential is analog. The more stimulus, the bigger you get. But an action potential is like a digital signal of zeros and ones. All you get is zero or one. Just if there's more stimulus, you get more ones. You get more action potentials. Now, there are a few other things that are perhaps worth thinking about, which is, what kind of channels does it take to cause these two? What kind of channels do you have to open? What gates them? So why don't you think about that for a minute? What gates the channels? What's the difference between the two kinds of channels responsible for these two? Well, you could say it's a difference in the ions that move, but that's not what I was thinking about. What I was thinking about, what gates the channels? This? Voltage?
No.
Ligands?
Yes.
These are ligand-gated channels. That there are chemicals, the neurotransmitters, that cause the opening or closing of these channels, either directly or indirectly. But what kind of channels do you need to get an action potential? You have to have voltage-gated channels to get an action potential. Because remember, although we didn't write it down here, that an action potential regenerates itself, like the fuse. And in order for one signal to regenerate the next, regenerate the next, regenerate the next, you need voltage-gated channels. Postsynaptic potentials die off. They don't regenerate. They're local. And if they're big enough to go over threshold, good. If they're not, they just die out. But they don't regenerate each other. Okay. Now, I want to leave this and talk about sensors, but before I do that, let me ask what questions there are before we go on. Yeah?
Are postsynaptic cells always non-nerve cells, meaning that...
Is the postsynaptic cell always a nerve, not a nerve cell?
Yeah.
Well, no. You can have a signal going from one nerve to the next nerve. That's what we've been talking about. That you can have, in these pictures, you have one nerve synapsing on another nerve. So you can have a nerve-nerve, or down the line, the final nerve usually contacts something which is not a nerve, either a muscle or a gland, for example, and causes it to do something. So this end is called an effector, and it is not a nerve, but everything else is. And we'll talk about how muscles and glands respond to nerves later. Yeah?
So then you would get an action potential in the second nerve cell that's higher than the usual because you have a lot of...
Do you get an action potential here that's higher than usual? What did we say about the size of action potentials? They're always the same. But if you get more input, what's going to happen? The frequency of action potentials going down here is going to be higher. It's going to be larger. So if you fire the action potential and there's a lot of excitatory input, you'll be right above threshold again and fire another action potential and fire another action potential. But each action potential is going to be exactly the same, just like, you'll excuse me, each toilet flush is the same size. But you either get a lot of them in a hurry or you only get a few. Yes?
Does the action potential require only voltage? Does it need some chemically gated ones to get started?
Does the action potential require any chemically gated ones? Well, these channels here are opened chemically. And this is, but to get the actual spike requires voltage gated channels. And so this is usually not considered formally, I guess, part of the action potential. Although when people draw an action potential, they always put it in. But you're right that to get an action potential started, you do need graded ligand-gated channel, graded potentials generated by ligand-gated channels. Yeah?
So is the first part of every action potential a PSP?
Is the first part of every action potential an excitatory postsynaptic potential? Well, I suppose you could say that, but people don't usually put it that way. What he's saying is this is a graded potential caused by the opening of ligand-gated channels. That's correct. But the rest of it is all caused by voltage-gated channels. You don't get a regenerating signal unless you open voltage-gated channels. Okay. So now I want to take a brief look at sensors, which are, in a way, a variation on the same routine. The question really is, how does a small stimulus from the environment trigger anything? Everything we've talked about involves one cell firing and hitting another cell. So you can see, okay, once that gets started, this one hits this one, hits this one, hits this one. But how do you get input from the environment or from outside? How do you get the whole thing started? So the short answer is that you have special cells which contain special proteins. And both of these are sometimes called receptors or sensors. But you have sensory or receptive cells, and on their surface, they have receptor proteins. So the stimulus, light, heat, chemicals as in food, bind to or trigger changes in the receptor proteins, and that causes the sensory cell to eventually fire an action potential or to release neurotransmitter so the next cell will fire an action potential. But the basic idea is that the stimulus is detected by the change in conformation of a receptor protein. That leads to the opening or closing of channels, which leads to ultimately the firing of an action potential. Now, this is diagrammed out in a little more detail on the top of 15A. So you have these sensory cells with their special proteins, and as we said, the stimulus causes a change in the conformation of the receptor protein. Now, how does that lead to any action? These receptor proteins, just like the ones we've been talking about, are either direct or indirect. They're either ionotropic or metabotropic. So they either open channels directly, or they trigger a set of biochemical steps that opens a channel. So that's why on the top of the handout, I've written stimulus, and you get opening of channels. I've got two circles. And the reason for that is either you can do it directly, because you can have a receptor protein that is itself a channel, or you can do it indirectly, because you have a receptor protein, which is a G protein coupled receptor, so that when it changes conformation, it triggers a G protein, which triggers some enzymatic change in a second messenger, and that opens channels. Now, I've taken the examples out of the notes, because I didn't want to get into the fine points, but in case you're curious, all the mechanical senses, like balance and hearing, they use direct receptors. But all the chemical senses, like taste and smell, use indirect ones. And light also uses an indirect one. You are not responsible for keeping straight which actual sensory system uses what. What you should be able to do is, given the results, to figure out what kind we're dealing with. Now, you can see on your handout that once you open some channels, these, remember, are not voltage-gated channels. In order to get a real response to your brain, you have to generate an action potential by opening voltage-gated channels. You have to get the big bang or the toilet flush. And the question is, how do you get that? And there are two basic ways of doing it, as shown on your handout. One is that the sensory special cell itself fires an action potential. That this part of the cell has the receptors on it. But when you get more and more stimulus, do you get a graded potential, the same potential? What happens? These things work, these receptor proteins work very much like the receptors that generate IPSPs and EPSPs. The more stimulus you get, the more receptor molecules deform, and the more graded potential you get in the cell. The more change in the resting membrane potential, either up or down. So you generate a graded potential, like an IPSP or an EPSP, one that is local and either reaches threshold or it doesn't. And this is usually called a receptor potential or a generator potential. Now, if this goes over the threshold, then it triggers an action potential. And that action potential can be in another part of the same cell. If this is the right picture, where are the voltage-gated channels? This part or that part? The voltage-gated channels have to be over here because that's where the action potential is. So you get a graded potential in response to the stimulus, and if it's large enough, it triggers an action potential. Now, in some systems, it takes two cells, and the second cell has the voltage-gated channels and generates the action potential. And that's shown in the picture on the top. You have a cell that has the receptors. The more stimulus, the more local change in potential, graded potential, and the more neurotransmitter. But this cell never fires an action potential. But the neurotransmitter then impinges on the next cell, and if there's enough of it, there's a graded potential in the next cell, and if it's large enough, it triggers an action potential. So number two has an action potential. Well, so what? How do you know that you tasted or saw something? Because this neuron contacts another neuron, which eventually leads to the brain. And if this is, say, a receptor for stretch, which works with one cell, then this is wired to a part of your brain that responds to stretch. So if you trigger off this cell and fire an action potential at it, your brain will think that you have stretched, even if you manage to trigger this some other way. So how do you know there's more or less stretch? It's going to be the number of action potentials. More stretch, more graded potential, more likelihood of firing an action potential, therefore closer series, more action potentials in a row, therefore more stimulus to brain. So the wiring determines what you think it is. And this is the famous example of if you get punched in the eye, you trigger the light receptors and you think you see stars. Now there is a less destructive, scary version of this. When you get home, you probably don't have one with you, but if you have a sharp pencil and you go like this on your upper lip, you will trigger a bunch of receptors you did not know were there. And you will have a sensation which is quite surprising. It's not of touch. And the reason for that is there are a bunch of receptors there, and they think they were triggered by their normal stimulus, and that goes to the right part of the brain, and your brain registers a stimulus other than touch. So you can try it when you get home. Okay. I know somebody's sitting there like this, right? If you think what it is just the pencil lead, try it on here. Because you don't have any of those receptors over here. So I want to leave sensors for now then. That's really all I wanted to say about them. And I want to talk about another matter. So let me ask if there are questions about this. Yeah.
What's stretch?
You have in your muscles what amounts to something that's sort of like a coil. And when you literally stretch your muscle, you put stretch on that, and that's detected and sent to your brain. Most of the time, you are unaware of stretch. But the stretch receptors are largely used to keep your various muscles in balance so that you do not fall over. For example, when you pick up something heavy, that pulls on the stretch receptors, and you have to pull back harder to keep from dropping it or falling over. And that's completely unconscious, but that's what they're for. Yeah?
If the hearing is not a graded signal, what dictates the volume?
Is the hearing not a graded signal? It's not a graded signal in the sense that what you hear is determined by what you think the number of action potentials. I assume that the pitch depends on exactly which cells you trigger for hearing, and the volume depends on the number of action potentials per second. Now, if you're interested in this sensory business, which is quite fascinating, there is a whole chapter in Sadhava, and of course in any physiology book, which explains each of the senses in turn, what the molecular basis is, the number of cells involved, and how it works. Yes?
I just cooked my lip a whole bunch. I was wondering what else there is to
do. What do you think?
I have no idea.
Did anybody else detect anything?
No.
Do you have a really sharp pencil?
Sharp
It has to be pretty sharp. I don't want to give it away. You tell me next time. Okay? If you get a really sharp lead pencil, it works. I don't know if it works with a mechanical pencil. Is that what you have?
Yeah.
Yeah. May not be sharp enough. Because the tip is dull on a mechanical pencil. Yeah? I'll tell you next time. Remember to ask me. Yeah?
So up on the top,
yeah,
cell generates the second action potential.
This one?
Yeah. Do those neurotransmitters that are first released count as post-synaptic potentials?
So what would you call what happens to this cell? I think is his question. This neurotransmitter generates a standard IPSP or EPSP in the cell, in this cell. But the amount of it's going to depend on the amount of neurotransmitter, which is going to depend on the amount of the original stimulus. And if that is over threshold, you'll fire an action potential. Okay. Now, I want to talk about something which really sort of combines what we've been saying about chemical signaling and what we've been saying about nervous signaling. That when you send a message down an axon, that's an electrical change. But when you send a message across a synapse, that's chemical signaling, which is extremely similar to signaling with hormones, to paracrine signaling, all the kinds of signaling we talked about earlier. And I want to consider again the question of how do you get different responses to the same signal? We said, for example, that in some cases with norepinephrine, sometimes you get an inhibitory signal, sometimes you get an excitatory signal. Why is that? Now, in the case of norepinephrine, and in many other cases, it's a different in receptors, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But is there any way you can get a different response from the same receptor? Now, the answer, of course, is yes. And I want to consider an example. The example I'm going to use is a response to epinephrine, which is a hormone, but a similar argument would go for any kind of chemical signaling, whether it was a neurotransmitter, hormone, wouldn't matter. If you, epinephrine causes changes in many, many different target tissues. And the two I want to start with are skeletal muscle and the smooth muscle. You have smooth muscle in many places surrounding many different kinds of tubes. And this one I'm going to talk about lung smooth muscle. Now, epinephrine causes totally different responses in these two cell types. In skeletal muscle, it affects glycogen metabolism. It causes the breakdown of glycogen. And in smooth muscle of lung, it causes relaxation. Now, before we get into how this works, let's ask, does this make any sense? Epinephrine is the hormone that is released in response to stress. The traditional example is the lion in the street. You are very unlikely to meet a lion in the street. However, you are very likely to have a pop quiz, not in this class, but in other classes. So if you have an immediate crisis, like a pop quiz or short-term stress, you release adrenaline or epinephrine. That's a hormone, so it travels through your blood. And it binds to receptors on many different cell types. Now, does it make sense that it causes breakdown of glycogen? Glycogen is a storage form of glucose. It's just glucose, 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 glucose. It's saved for emergencies. And it makes sense that in response to stress, the glycogen is broken down into glucose, actually glucose phosphate, so that it can be metabolized and you can get energy. So the idea that you mobilize glucose in response to stress Good idea. That makes sense. Now, why should the smooth muscle surrounding the small tubes or bronchioles of your lung relax? Why does that make any sense? You have to breathe more deeply to deal with the stress. It's much more obvious when you have to run away from the lion. But even to take the pop quiz, you've got to get some oxygen in. You've got to get that brain going. So in addition to needing more glucose, you also need to take in more oxygen. So it makes sense that the muscles of your lung relax and that you breathe more deeply. Now, how does this work? It turns out that the receptors involved on the two cell types are exactly the same. That in this case, in both cases, you have the same receptor, and it activates the PKA pathway. So that means the receptor activates a G protein. The G protein activates adenyl cyclase, and you get cyclic AMP, etc. And in fact, if you look at 15B on the top, this is just a repeat or a reprise of the handout, what was on the handout 12C, showing you have the receptor, you have the ligand, the G protein, and the adenyl cyclase. So adenyl cyclase then is activated, and that generates cyclic AMP, and that activates PKA. So you end up with activated protein kinase A. Now, why does that produce a different result? Same active enzyme. Because the target proteins within these two specialized cells are totally different. Each cell type is making a different set of proteins. So the proteins that can be phosphorylated by PKA in smooth muscle are different than the proteins that can be phosphorylated by PPKA in skeletal muscle. In skeletal muscle, the enzymes of glycogen metabolism are phosphorylated. That activates the ones for breakdown and inhibits the ones for synthesis. So it's the enzymes of glycogen metabolism that get phosphorylated. But in smooth muscle, one of the proteins that's required for contraction is phosphorylated. So here it's a contraction protein. And it gets phosphorylated. And that prevents contraction, because you need the unphosphorylated form to get any contraction. So that blocks contraction. So these smooth muscle cells relax, and this skeletal muscle breaks down glycogen. Now, I think there's a simple analogy to this. If you go back to Dr. Feierstein's example of if you punch somebody in the eye, they will see light. Well, suppose you punch a big, strong, strapping guy or a little wimp. Do you get the same response? Both of them have the same receptor, the eye. Both of them see light, but one of them punches you back and one of them probably won't. Now, this is the same kind of difference. You have a different setup. Now, you can think another example. You know, if you tickle your boyfriend or you tickle a stranger, you may get a very different response. So the makeup of the target is different. So that even though you generate same active principle, PKA, cyclic AMP, etc., the response is totally different. Now, this is one way to get a different response out of the same signal. But there are, in fact, other ways. And one of the other ways is using two different receptors. And that's what I want to talk about next. We've indicated that can happen with our adrenergic and our cholinergic receptors, but I want to do an actual example. It turns out that epinephrine on some smooth muscle causes relaxation. In skeletal muscle, it causes breakdown of glycogen. But in other smooth muscle, such as that around your peripheral blood vessels, it causes contraction. Now, your blood vessels are very branched. The arteries branch into what are called arterioles. And it's the smooth muscle. Remember we said smooth muscle is around tubes. It's the smooth muscle around your arterioles that contracts, that around in the periphery. That's important. It's not the arterioles of your, say, liver or your brain that are contracted, but the smooth muscle around your peripheral, that is in your external, in your limbs, though the smooth muscle around those small blood vessels contracts. Why would you do that if there was a pop quiz? Why do you think?
To raise your blood pressure.
To raise your blood pressure. How would this raise your blood pressure? It forces the blood into a smaller area of tubing because you're going to have less circulation in your extremities and more in your main body. Now, probably the bad part of this is it raises your blood pressure. The good part of this, though, is that it diverts the blood flow from your limbs, which can manage without maximum blood flow for a little bit, and directs it to your brain and to your internal organs, which need to be well nourished and to function properly at this moment. So the basic idea here is to divert the blood flow from where the blood carrying nutrients and oxygen is not so necessary to where you really need it. Now you notice what this means is that you have two types of smooth muscle, which a smooth muscle is pretty similar to other smooth muscle. And yet, in response to the same signal, one contracts and one relaxes. And the explanation for this is that they have two different kinds of epinephrine receptors. The receptors are actually different. Now, for this, you have to go back and look at 15B again. This handout was originally made to illustrate two different signaling pathways. On the top, we have one receptor and one ligand. They trigger a G protein which activates adenyl cyclase, PKA, etc. In the second panel, we have a different receptor and a different ligand. But the truth is, this could be the same ligand as in the top example. Now, if this is the same ligand, that means the binding site on the receptor is similar, but these two receptors are not the same. So we would have to change the shape here somehow, which on the next edition of the handout I will do. So we have two different receptors. They could be for two different ligands, but in this particular example, they're actually for the same ligand. But one is on the surface of lung smooth muscle, and one is on the surface of arterioral smooth muscle. And these two receptors bind different G proteins and target different enzymes and generate different second messages. The only second messenger we talked about was cyclic AMP. And that's the one you get here because you activate adenyl cyclase and you get cyclic AMP. Though we did mention cyclic GMP. Now, in this case, you activate a different G protein in the second panel, and it activates a different enzyme. Instead of adenyl cyclase, it activates the enzyme phospholipase C. Now that means it breaks down a phospholipid that is already in the membrane. And the structure of that lipid is shown on the bottom here. This is glycerol with two fatty acids. Now you may remember that the way these kinds of lipids look is that glycerol is able to attach to three things. So in In phospholipids in membranes, it attaches to two fatty acids, and then it attaches to a phosphate, and then usually to some kind of water-soluble base, which in this case is inositol. So if you looked at your membrane, this thing would be sticking into the membrane like this. This part is the head, or water-soluble part, and it would be sticking out into the cytoplasm, and then the fatty acids would be sticking into the membrane, into the bilayer. Now, what is in the membrane is actually not just phosphatidyl inositol, but what is called PIP2, or PI bisphosphate. It has a lot of names. It has two more phosphates on it. Inositol is a 6-carbon compound, sort of like a sugar, but it doesn't have any oxygen in the ring. But the interesting thing about inositol is it has 6 hydroxyls on it. So there's 6 different places to put the phosphate. So it appears to be actually a big deal in signaling, because you can make many versions of it. Because you can put the phosphate on the 1 and the 4, or the 3 and the 5, and different versions of it are used for different purposes. But the most famous version of it is this one. This was the second messenger to be discovered. That this compound here is found in the membrane. And when phospholipase C is activated, what it does is to break this connection. Now, the advantage of that is it leaves the lipid-soluble part in the membrane, and the water-soluble part is released into the cytoplasm. And the water-soluble part is usually called IP3, because it's inositol with 3 phosphates. And the part that remains in the membrane is called diacylglycerol, or DAG. Now, either of these, or both, can act as second messengers. And we're going to ignore the DAG part for now. It can only move in the membrane. And we're going to concentrate on the IP3 part. IP3 is almost as famous as cyclic AMP as a second messenger. So it's the same idea that the ligand binds the receptor, which activates the G protein, which activates a membrane-associated enzyme, which generates a small molecule second messenger in the cytoplasm. We know what cyclic AMP does. It binds to protein kinase A and activates it. What is IP3 famous for? What does it do? And its main job, as shown in this picture, is it binds to the ER, to the endoplasmic reticulum. And it causes calcium to be released from the endoplasmic reticulum. That, as Dr. Feierstein said, the calcium inside a cell is very low. So a release of small amounts of calcium can act as a signal. Now, the calcium inside the cell is very low because there are pumps that move it out of the cell or into the ER. So calcium is stored in the ER. It's very low in the cytoplasm, but there's much more calcium in the endoplasmic reticulum and lumen. And so this sound serves as a source. And IP3 opens a channel. Now, why is that enough? Why don't you need transport or something? Active transport? Calcium is much higher inside the ER. Very low in the cytoplasm. So if we open a channel, there, calcium will go down its gradient into the cytoplasm. We get a wave or burst of calcium, which now serves as, depending on your point of view, a third messenger or a different second messenger. So calcium itself is a very important agent. And calcium directly often has effects. We know, for example, that it promotes exocytosis. And the calcium is also required for muscle contraction. So it is the calcium that triggers the calcium, that triggers the contraction through the IP3 pathway. So what is going on here is that we have 2 different adrenergic receptors. We have one... We have a so-called beta adrenergic receptor, These are in the table, I think, both of these. Both of these have the same receptor, remember? And the beta-adrenergic receptor always works through cyclic AMP. But the smooth muscle one is an alpha-1 so-called adrenergic receptor, and it works through the so-called IP3 pathway. So in one case, you prevent contraction, and in one place, you stimulate contraction. Same signal, but different receptors. Now, there are more details on this handout, which is largely for reference, to indicate that sometimes calcium works by itself, sometimes in association with a protein called calmodulin, and there's also the issue of what DAG does. And we may or may not return to this. The critical thing to realize is the IP3. And in your notes are some details about the medical implications of all this, which I won't go into. I think we have the exams here to give back. So if there are any, everybody realizes that 10 points were added to your score because the exam was harder than expected. And so the number on your paper is, you'd have to add 10 to the number on your paper to get your recorded important score. If there are any TAs here, so we'll give out first the morning exam. Notice my office hours today are different than the usual Tuesday.
Professor, those are both G proteins, right?
What?
They're both G proteins.
Yeah, it says, but thank you, yeah. Did I say?